Welcome to podcast number one. My name is David Mendelson, and I've been a part-time teacher in the TAFE system for the past 13 and a half years, and I am an in-house lawyer for a major public sector trade union, and I've also practiced law privately as a barrister and solicitor in New South Wales. And I'll be talking to Kelvin Postlethwaite, who is a solicitor and has been teaching legal subjects on a full-time basis in TAFE for the past 22 years. Hello, Kel.
Hi, David.
We're talking about the origins of law, so could you first give a bit of an outline of the origins of our Australian legal system?
Yes, David. As probably most people are aware that are listening to this podcast, Australia was originally a colony of Great Britain, and the colony was made up of the what is now basically the states in Australia. So we've inherited the English legal system, along with English customs and the language and many other things. And so the origins of law can be addressed in terms of, firstly, the common law, which originated in England in the Middle Ages. That was a period of roughly between 1100 and 1600 AD. And at that time, the king appointed circuit judges to travel around from town to town, village to village, hearing legal disputes. And these circuit judges, if I can call them that, would periodically return to London, where they would meet each other, and many of them developed the habit of recording the reasons for their decisions. And in due course, these judges would follow their earlier decisions in cases that they were hearing, not only their own decisions, but also decisions of their fellow judges. And over the centuries, what developed was a system of law that was common throughout the whole of England. And in Australia, we've adopted this common law system, and it still works very well today. Now, the next thing I want to mention is equity. Now, equity law is concerned with fairness. And if I can just jump back to England in the Middle Ages again, sometimes the common law was found to be harsh or unjust. And in these circumstances, people were entitled to complain to the king. And the king could use his powers to override an unfair or unjust application of the common law. Over time, of course, the king got too many complaints and set up a special chancery court or equity court to deal with matters of fairness and justice. And again, these equity courts still exist today, both in England and Australia, where if the common law is found to be unfair or unconscionable, then the equity courts can override that law. Finally, I want to talk about statute law. Now, statute law is laws made by the Parliament. In Australia, we have a federal parliament and we have state parliaments in each of the states. The important thing about statute law is that once it's enacted, it overrides the common law.
Thank you, Kel. And having explained where our laws come from, can you briefly outline the development of the legal system in Australia?
Yes, David, I'll try. This is an interesting area to me. And to me, the most critical aspect is that in Australia, we had evolution, not revolution. Now, the United States, like Australia, was a colony of England. Now, they had a war of independence to remove the British from their shores, whereas what we've done in Australia is we've just let things progress over a period of time, and very slowly, incrementally, if you like, we've changed our legal and governmental system to the point where in 1901, Australia became an independent nation. Now, prior to that, there was the establishment, first of all, of a legislative council, a parliament in the state of New South Wales, or sorry, in the colony of New South Wales. There was the establishment of a Supreme Court. But when the British first arrived here in 1788, what applied then was the doctrine of reception, where the laws of England became the laws of the colony of New South Wales. Now, I mentioned the Constitution, which came into effect on the 1st of January 1901. Now, this, in fact, was a British Act of Parliament. It was created by a constitutional convention in the colonies of Australia, but legally and formally it needed to be approved by the British Parliament, which it was in 1900, and it came into effect in 1901. And in simple terms, you can say the Constitution is our book of rules that sets up our system of government and our legal system. It's interesting to note that that's not the end of the story. The evolutionary process continues. It wasn't until 1986, for example, where we could no longer appeal to the Privy Council Court in London from decisions of Australian courts, which seems quite remarkable given that we became supposedly an independent nation in 1901. I should point out that we still have the British flag tacked in the corner of our own flag. Maybe that's something we need to address in the future. Also, of course, we still have a British head of state, that is, the Governor-General of the Commonwealth of Australia, represents Queen Elizabeth II of England. So this evolutionary process of us becoming an independent nation is probably not quite complete.
Now, you mentioned earlier statute law, that is, laws made by Parliament, which, if they conflict with the common law, override the common law. So can you outline how our parliaments make laws?
Yes, I'll try. I think the first thing that happens is somebody comes up with an idea. Now, the idea might come from, you know, the Prime Minister or the Premier, some senior members of Parliament, perhaps the trade union movement or business, big business or even small business. The idea might have come from public opinion, maybe people ringing up radio programs on the talkback. So the idea is then put into some sort of written form, which is called a bill. Now, a bill is a draft law. It's prepared and written up by government lawyers or parliamentary draftspersons. Then the bill is then tabled in the Parliament, and it goes through what we call three readings. And the first reading is simply where the member of Parliament, usually the minister, introduces the bill and puts the bill on the table so that others can read it. Of course, in this modern age with the internet, the members of Parliament would simply go back to their office and log on to their computer and have a look at the draft legislation. Then comes the second reading, which involves debate and discussion, followed by the third reading, which is the committee stage. And quite often, the members of Parliament will decide to form a small committee to consider the draft law or the bill in further detail. Now, the committee is often made up of what they call a joint parliamentary committee, so it's both government and opposition members and sometimes some independent members of Parliament. The committee, in due course, having met maybe a number of occasions, will then submit a report to the Parliament. Finally, there's the vote. So the final stage is that the bill will be voted on, and usually the government has a majority, therefore the bill will be passed. Now, it's still not a law yet, because certainly in New South Wales or in the federal Parliament, this whole process needs to be repeated in the upper house. So the upper house in the federal sphere is the Senate, and the upper house in the New South Wales parliamentary system is called the Legislative Council. So once the upper house goes through this process and finally votes on and approves the bill will become law when it receives the royal assent, that is, it's signed off by the Governor of New South Wales or the Governor-General in Canberra, and it's gazetted. And then what was a bill then becomes an Act of Parliament.
Thanks, Kel. Now, we've talked about the Commonwealth Constitution.
Yes.
And it sets out the powers of the Commonwealth Parliament. And these are commonly referred to as being either exclusive powers or residual powers. Can you explain the distinction between those two types of power?
Yes. The Constitution of the Commonwealth of Australia in Section 51 sets out a number of lawmaking powers of the Federal Parliament. And the exclusive powers include things like making laws about immigration, about external affairs, which is like relationships with other nations, banking, insurance, post-telegraphic, telephonic, telecommunications, and so on. Now, the residual powers are, in effect, those that are not mentioned there, and they are, in effect, the powers that are left over for the states.
Now, sometimes it happens that the Commonwealth Parliament will make a law under one of its heads of power under Section 51, and sometimes a state parliament will make a law which it has the power to make, but there'll be some conflict between the two laws. They can't both operate together. What happens in that case?
Well, the Constitution itself addressed this possibility in Section 109, and what it basically says is, where there is a conflict between a federal and a state law, the federal law will prevail to the extent of the inconsistency.
Now, when matters are before a court, we often hear reference to the onus or burden of proof on the one hand and the standard of proof on the other. Can you explain the difference between these two concepts?
Yes, I think students often confuse these, and so do the teachers sometimes. If I can just talk about burden of proof, the basic rule that I learnt in law school was that he who asserts or she who asserts must prove. So, for example, in a civil case, if a plaintiff is suing a defendant for breach of contract, it's the plaintiff who has the burden or the onus of proof. It's the plaintiff that's got to do the proving. Similarly, in a criminal case, the prosecution, that is the police or someone representing the government, the Crown, if the Crown is asserting that someone has committed a crime, then they've got to prove that a crime was committed. Now, that's a general rule. Moving to the standard of proof, this, in effect, concerns the degree of proof required. In a civil case, the standard of proof is on the balance of probabilities. However, in a criminal matter, it's much higher. It's beyond reasonable doubt.
Now, as we all know, court proceedings can become very expensive. So increasingly there's a move towards trying to settle disputes out of court by means of what is known as alternative dispute resolution. Can you explain the general idea of alternate dispute resolution for us?
Yeah, the general idea is basically that to take a matter to court is extremely expensive. Most ordinary salary and wage earners couldn't afford to run a court case. Even if you can, even if you're a big corporation, it could still cost a lot of money to take a matter, for example, to the High Court or the Supreme Court. And not only will it cost a lot of money, it'll take a lot of time. There is often uncertainty as to whether the action will be successful. If it's unsuccessful, there's a risk that not only will you lose the case, but that you might have to pay some of the legal costs of the other side. Therefore, the idea of alternate dispute resolution was conceived. And there's a number of places that one can, or institutions or bodies, where one can go in under the sort of general heading or umbrella of alternate dispute resolution. It might be, for example, where the parties have predetermined in a contract that if there's a dispute about a lease, a residential lease, then they might go to the Residential Tenancies Tribunal. Or if it's a contract between two businesses or corporations, they might have already decided that, say, if it's to do with real estate, they might go to the President of the Real Estate of New South Wales or his or her nominee. There are also, perhaps under this heading, small claims tribunals, where usually solicitors aren't welcome, which means it's cheaper. The fees to start a proceedings there are quite modest, maybe $100 or $40 if you're a pensioner. And the rules of evidence don't apply, so the procedure can be moved along rather quickly. And also these tribunals don't have the sort of formality of a court where judges and barristers are wearing wigs and gowns and the like. So just to sum up, alternate dispute resolution, the notion behind it is that it's going to be cheaper and faster and quicker. The parties might agree to be bound by the decision of the arbitrator or the conciliator, or it might be predetermined that they're not bound so that they can still go off to a court if they're not happy. It just depends on what kind of tribunal or body it is. By the way, the conciliator or the arbitrator can and often is these days a private barrister or maybe a retired judge. Some retired judges have made quite a handsome living out of acting as arbitrators and conciliators.
Now, Kel, can you tell us a little bit about the now famous case of Mabo versus the State of Queensland and what the significance of that was?
Yes, David. This case was reported in 1992. It was decided by the High Court of Australia, and it's, you know, what we call a landmark case. And it concerned native title. The Murray Islander people, who are Indigenous Australians, had occupied these islands off the coast of far north Queensland for a long, long time. And Eddie Mabo, representing the local community, made a claim for title to the land, that is, claiming that the land should not belong to the Crown or the Queensland government, that it should belong to those people, the Murray Islanders, who had been occupying it for a long, long time. Now, the matter eventually went to the High Court, and in its judgment, the High Court ruled in favour of Mabo, and in so doing, they undid a long-standing doctrine, which was the doctrine of terra nullius, which basically said that when the British arrived here in 1788, Australia was an empty land. Now, this is of course a fiction, because we all know that the land was occupied by native Australians. However, it was a convenient legal fiction because it allowed the British to say, well, because the land is empty, it belongs to us, the British Crown. Now, Mabo, representing his community, said, well, the Murray Islanders should really belong not to the Queensland Crown, but to us, the Murray Islanders. And the High Court agreed. And the High Court said, in effect, in order to succeed in a claim for native title, the plaintiffs would have to show two things. One is that the native or Indigenous community had occupied the land for a continuous period. That is, the occupation needed to be continuous, uninterrupted. And secondly, that the land in question had not been alienated. That is, it hadn't been transferred by the Crown or sold by the Crown to somebody else. So, provided these two things could be satisfied, it would then allow a successful native title claim. David, can I just ask you, if you talk about a following case of Wallace versus Downard Pickford?
Yes, Kel, that case illustrates the conflict of laws situation, which is resolved by Section 109 of the Australian Constitution, which says that a valid Commonwealth law overrides a valid state law to the extent of the inconsistency, because there is an Act of the Commonwealth Parliament called the Trade Practices Act 1974, which, amongst a whole lot of other things, says that a corporation engaged in trade or commerce, in providing services, must do so with reasonable care and skill. And if they fail to do that, the customer who suffers loss or damage can sue them for the full amount of that loss or damage. There is also an act of the Queensland State Parliament, and there is a similar act in every other state, called the Common Carriers Act, which limits the amount of damage that can be recovered from a common carrier to a small amount of money. It was about $200 at the time this case took place. And what happened was that Mr. and Mrs. Wallace were moving house. They engaged Downard Pickford, who were removalists, to move their possessions for them. In the course of doing that, there was some negligence by the employees of Downard Pickford. Some of the possessions of Mr. and Mrs. Wallace were damaged. The amount of the damage came to about $2,600. They sued Downard Pickford for $2,600. Downard Pickford said, no, we're only obliged to pay you $100 or $200, whatever the limit was under the Queensland Common Carriers Act at the time. And eventually it went up the line, I think eventually to the High Court, where the High Court said that Downard Pickford had to pay the full amount of the damages because you had a valid Commonwealth law, the Trade Practices Act, you had an otherwise valid state law. They were in conflict in that one said that the carrier only had to pay $100 or $200, and the other said they had to pay the full amount of the damages. Therefore, there was a conflict. Therefore, the Commonwealth law prevails, which is the Trade Practices Act, and Downard Pickford have to fully compensate Mr. and Mrs. Wallace.
Oh, thanks for explaining that. Cheers.